Welcome to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. I'm your host, Kathy Nelson, an electrical engineer who loves to hear and share stories of other women in STEM. Today's guest is very special to me for a couple of reasons. First of all, we went to school together, starting in grammar school and all the way through high school. So we share many of the same math teacher influences that got us into engineering. Secondly, Cynthia does some amazing work in the advocacy space, which is something I have done a little of in my profession, but would like to do more of personally, especially now. Our voices are so very important. I also want to point out that this podcast episode was recorded in early May. We talk about the leaked version of the Roe versus Wade reversal, which is now official. I just want to note that because it may be a little confusing with the delay in getting this episode released. So, on to today's guest. Today's guest is Cynthia Chenyet Levin. She is the author of the newly published book, From Changing Diapers to Changing the World, Why Moms Make Great Advocates and How to Get Started. Cynthia has a bachelor's and master's degrees in mechanical engineering. I am absolutely delighted to have reconnected with her, and I hope you enjoy her story.
Hey.
Hi. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
I am really excited to have you on the podcast. We have known each other. I don't even know, like when I would have first met you a long, long time ago, even though we haven't talked to each other for a very, very long time.
You went to Postfield, right?
I did.
I'm trying to remember the names of my teachers. In the third grade, it was Mrs. Nass.
I remember second grade. One of the things that I talk about in this podcast is Mrs. Prom, who was my second grade teacher. Did you know Mrs. Prom?
Really? Oh, well, I knew her through STEP, like the...
Yes, that's what it was. Yes.
Yeah.
Like the...
Well, that might have been where we met up first.
Was that the summer camp?
Or
was it the after-school thing?
It was a pull-out class for me at Probstfield. Yeah. I was never in like her class as like a regular...
I was in her class and then I was in STEP. Okay, so here's how I talk about her. So, and maybe she didn't lead the summer camp, but she maybe have put me in the summer camp. I don't totally remember, but I shadowed a woman architect for a week between second and third grade, which... made me want to be an architect. So from like third grade until my freshman year of college, I wanted to be an architect. Then I found out that there's a lot of art in architecture and not as much math and science, even though you need to have better grades in math to get into the School of Architecture, at least at NDSU, than you did in engineering. So I changed majors. But the fact that I shadowed a female architect in like the early 1980s is mind-boggling to me.
That's pretty amazing. I never did anything like that. That is really cool.
It's amazing to me that there was a program like that, honestly. Like that at that point in time, there's probably like five teachers that were like life-changing for me or that got me into engineering. And she was one of them.
She was pretty cool.
She was pretty cool. And then there's Mr. Marston, fifth grade math. And then Mr. Argent.
Mr. Argent was pretty life-changing.
And then Dr. Legg, who was my calculus professor when I did PSEO at Morehead State. My senior year, like he was also life-changing for me. So I am really excited to have you on the podcast because we have gone to school together and we were childhood friends. I know like kind of in high school, we kind of like probably didn't talk a ton. I'm even trying to like think like when we didn't hang out when we were little.
Activities overlapping in high school. So it wasn't like I didn't like you.
But we were kind of like in different circles, but so that's a whole nother thing that I do want to come back to. Like once we like, cause we have a lot of like other like STEM stuff to talk about and advocacy stuff to talk about, which I've actually been talking a lot about advocacy lately on the podcast. So it's kind of a very interesting, we briefly talked about the fact that you've run marathons. And so I'm like, where the hell were you in like cross country? conversation we need to have.
Yeah, I never ran in high school.
I know.
Yeah, that like came to me like later in life. It was sometimes when people come up and ask like, or they say, "I heard you ran a marathon. I'm thinking about running a marathon. Can we talk about it?" It's like, well, first can we talk about what's going on in your life that you want to run a marathon? It's because for people like me who never ran before. It's often the whole like, oh, I just want to set a goal and I want to do it. So it's almost like a therapy thing first, because if it's for me, I was just at a point where I felt like I wanted to control something and take on a big, seemingly impossible goal, break it into little bits and then achieve it.
Oh, interesting. Okay, because when you first said that, I was thinking that you were going to say that it is a was a way for you to process things, which is what I use running for. So I have ran most of my marathons when I've had like some shit to deal with that I need to like process, and I can go like process it on a long run. It's getting a little harder to process on runs now because the runs are getting harder. I'm getting slower. It's like not quite as much fun to like think through things anymore, but that's what I would use it for a lot of times. Yeah. So I thought, so when you said that, I was thinking that that, but also the whole goal setting thing is, I mean, that's a huge thing. And I will tell you, okay, so I'm going to like just deviate for a second. So I just signed up for another marathon with my daughter, which I had sworn I was never going to do another marathon, but my daughter, I'm supposed to run another marathon in like 4 years with a friend of mine that I've done my destination marathons with. And when I said this to my daughter, cause I was kind of complaining about it, she said, "Well, mom, I always thought that we would run a marathon together." And I'm like, damn it. I can't not run a marathon with my daughter when she asks me to. So we signed up to do Disney next January.
Oh, congratulations. I've run many Disney races.
Have you? Oh my gosh. The website crashed. So I was literally
on. Oh, I heard about that. That was spectacular.
Trying to get in. My husband was on two devices trying to get in for like 4 hours. It was crazy, but we got in. And so now I have to marathon train.
If one said that to me, I'd be saying, "Why didn't you say this before I turned 50?
but I will also say, so I just did a 10-mile run in DC like a month ago, and it's been a horrible winter up here. It's been like I would have sat on my couch if I had not had this goal, even a 10-mile run to do. And so I need a goal in order to get my butt off the couch, because Netflix is really interesting and my couch is very comfortable.
More interesting than it's ever been before. I will say that the Disney marathons are very expensive, but because they can be attached to an event, a family vacation and things like that, they were really important for me for my goal setting. And I ran my first one in 1994 when I first graduated from 1997. It was after my master's in mechanical engineering. And I was doing it before it was cool. Like, people cannot believe when they look at my pictures, because nobody's in costume and people are just showing up to run. And it wasn't a problem to register. It was not.
I know. There was no like websites crash. Well, there probably no websites when I did my first one in 1990. I did 10 cities. How many have you done?
Full marathons, I've only done Disney and Honolulu. And then there's been a whole bunch of half marathons that I would take up needless time in your podcast for me to sit here and count on my hands.
So Disney and Honolulu, like, those are lofty goals and fun races to do. Although I'm going to guess that Honolulu was probably hot, because I think Heidi Child did Honolulu. And I think she said like it starts like crazy early in the morning, right?
It does. And it's hot and hilly. And I'm not sure. This is what I said when I finished it. I was like, that was not my favorite race to do, but this is my favorite place to recover. Mm. A couple of days later, I was kayaking down a river in Hawaii. I'm thinking, you know, my legs are all like, you know, like isolated in the kayak. So I'm just using upper body strength. I'm like, this is really good.
Let's jump into what we're here to talk about, although I love talking about running. All right. So I have your book, read your book.
Oh, look at that.
Loved your book. So you wrote, "From Changing Diapers to Changing the World, Why Moms Make Great Advocates and How to Get Started," which I love because I got into doing some advocacy stuff. Mine was through work, and I didn't know anything about advocacy or how important it was, or even like how you do it, until I started doing it for work. And I had people who took me to the Hill. We had like a team that would prep us, kind of made it easy from a standpoint of understanding how the process works and stuff like that. How did you get into doing advocacy, and how did you get into writing a book? Two very like big questions. So we might have to come back.
I'm glad that you mentioned how you got into it, because that is, I would say, my number one recommendation of like how to get started is to get involved with a group that will help, you know, walk you through it, that is full of people who are going to train you and just make it easier. I took a different route.
I've read about that.
Yeah, I don't necessarily recommend what I do, but the book was written, to get to the second part of your question, the book was written to make the path easier for people who do what I did, which is to start with the idea, hey, I really care about an issue and I want to advocate, but I don't know how, I don't know where to start. I was a mom of very young children. And I was kind of struggling with this idea that I'd been an engineer. I, like mentioned before, I have a master's in mechanical engineering. I'd started my career and then I quit my job at the same time as my husband. Something else I don't recommend is two parents quitting their jobs at the same time. But he was starting a business and I just couldn't find the childcare that would have justified me staying in a job that I didn't particularly like and justified the cost of it. I was struggling at that point with a kind of identity problem because I saw myself as I'm a very educated woman and I'm working in corporate automotive America and stuff like that. And this was like a real sea change of a moment for me to be staying at home with my kids and just constantly involved in their lives in that baby and toddler way.
Can I interrupt for a second? So did you stay home like right away when your first was born?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. And I was just really wanting a way to kind of engage with the world. I was listening to the world's problems on the radio and not feeling like I could do anything about it. And a friend of mine, see, women friends always play a big part in our lives, and they can. She recognized what was going on with me and knew that I cared about food pantries and things like that. And she invited me into getting engaged with Bread for the World. She was a friend from church. That's a Christian advocacy group that works on primarily hunger issues around the world and in the US. And so I was invited to write my first letter to Congress. And I thought, oh no, if I write a letter, somebody's going to call me back and tell me I'm wrong, which, you know, that actually doesn't happen. They're really far too busy for that.
I totally understand. I totally understand that mindset because I would have had that same mindset.
Yep. They kind of coached me into, you know, how to make a call to Congress. And really we're talking about, you know, nonpartisan things like American children should have enough food. And, you know, that really, through my book, I try to tell people that this is all advocacy is just saying, I care about this issue to somebody in the power that has the opportunity to change the rules, to change policies, to help. So I was introduced through Bread for the World, but I wasn't fully involved because I kind of saw these barriers like, oh, they're holding their meetings when my kids have naps or my baby goes to bed at 6 p.m. I don't know that my second daughter was pretty easy, but that did mean that my life kind of ended at 6. And we didn't have webinars and we weren't connected in that way. So in a lot of ways, I was doing things on my own and trying to figure out how to advocate. So I want this book to be sort of the warm, friendly, funny friend that can be with you, walking you through the process. There's lots of step-by-step instructions, mm-hmm. and time-saving tips for moms or, you know, it could be any other people. Everybody's pressed for times these days. So that hopefully wraps up the answer of like how I first got involved and why I wrote the book at all.
I mean, I view it as like a how-to guide. I think it's like super easily digestible. And I swear I have like the attention span of a gnat these days. Like I have so many books that I will start reading and then I just like, they're just too in depth and too deep. And like, I will have to put them down. Yours was not like that. And it's in like these nice little chunks. And so if you do put it down, it's so easy to go back to. I will also say that about the time that we did our intro call and we were talking about your book, I had a friend from my work who was talking about having an interest in getting into advocacy. And so then I'm like looking at it through like this mindset when I was reading your book and I'm like, this is super applicable to whether you're a mom or not a mom, right? This is just like a how-to guide with like, here's how I did it. And here's some funny stories because I brought my kids along with me to the hill.
Right. Because whenever you introduce toddlers or, you know, children into formal settings, you know, hilarity ensues. It's just going to happen.
Okay. Yeah. So I do want to talk about that because I think it's okay. So I have this, and I don't know if this is just me, but like I have in my head before I went to, well, I still have this idea in my head and I've been to the Hill. It can be a very serious place. It could be, but it's not necessarily like as formal and serious as I think it necessarily seems. So I remember like one of the last times that I went, and I haven't done advocacy for a few years now, but I remember one of the times that I went, I'm sitting with like one of the lobbyists from my group, like waiting for us to get called in. And it was one of the first meetings of the day, you know, so like 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning or something. And we're sitting in like the very stiff chairs that are in the hallway while you're like waiting to be called in.
They don't want you to be too comfortable. Like,
they do not want you to be comfortable at all. And there was like, I swear, like 3 dogs that walked in, like without owners. Oh. And I was like,
wait, without owners?
Yes. Well, the owners came later.
Yeah, dogs are very common on the Hill.
It's like, oh my, like, where are these dogs coming from? Because they like walked into their offices.
Yeah, they know where they're going.
They know where they're going.
They have more experience on the Hill than you do.
To me. Like, oh my God. Like, people bring their dogs to work. And then like the lobbyist that I was with, he's like, oh yeah, there's a lot of dogs here. And I was like, yeah. I had no idea.
I've gotten to know some of the dogs, and sometimes I'll ask for them when I go in for meetings. I'm like, is Max here? Can Max play at the end of the meeting?
All right. So you would bring your kids when you started doing some advocacy, and I'm assuming you probably didn't bring them all the time, but probably sometimes, like, or was it all the time?
It was almost all the time in the district, like at home locally, which, by the way, local district meetings are much more informal than the ones on Capitol Hill. When it comes to going to DC, I did not bring either of my kids until they were about 8 or 9. I kind of had a rule about that. And even there's a mention of it in the book too, that, you know, you kind of have to be prepared to, days on the Hill are hard. There's a lot of walking. If you're spending the whole day doing it, there's a lot of space between the House and the Senate. I make a joke that, you know, it takes a lot of stamina and sometimes unexpected core strength. Like, I ended up piggybacking one of my kids from the Senate side to the House side. Something had happened with her shoe. I don't even know what it was.
Wait, so you had to piggyback her the whole way?
Yeah, I probably could have called for a cab, but I had like a whole, I was leading a group of volunteers and we couldn't all fit in the same cab. So I'm like, you know, just let's tough it out and mom it up. And I'm like, saddle up, sweetie.
Wow. That's ambitious.
Yeah. Well, I was running more marathons at the time. A lot of strength and endurance, but yeah, you don't want to be doing that too much. Now, having said that, all props to the moms of a particular lobby group. I'm going to give them a shout out, called Little Lobbyists. And one of the moms featured in my book, her name is Elena Hung. She is the founder of Little Lobbyists. And their mission is to raise awareness and change policy for children with complicated medical conditions. So their strategy is to take kids to the Hill so that, you know, kids that have oxygen tanks and trach tubes and wheelchairs, so that members of Congress can meet in person some of the kids that are so terribly affected by changes to health insurance policies. Mm-hmm. Now, they haven't been on the Hill for a long time because these kids cannot risk COVID.
Right.
But you can read about that more in the book, about how that came to be and some of the great relational things that happen when they do that. So I had it easy just taking my 9-year-old and slinging her over my back.
So you talk about wanting to take your experience to help moms, and I'm going to generalize a little bit, and other people like learn how to advocate and provide them like a how-to guide. Was there a point, like, what was the point that you went from like, okay, so I'm doing this, I'm advocating, I've got kids that I'm raising, which, I mean, that's a lot in itself, to going like, okay, I want to write a book, because that's a whole nother level of commitment. What brought that about?
There's a big step in there that's missing that we haven't talked about, which is blogging. And I used to laugh about it and say that I was blogging under duress. When I got involved with an organization called the United Nations Foundation's Shot at Life campaign, they work on global vaccines. And I was recruited because of my work on global health. And it was started with about 40 moms, and most of them were already bloggers. And they're like, Cindy, why aren't you blogging? You should be totally telling everybody. Cause I was the most, one of the most experienced advocates in the room, but they were really good at social media. This is how long ago it was. I mean, it was only 11 years ago, but I went to the conference and I thought, how rude. All these women are opening up their laptops right at the table while the speaker
And they're blogging.
They're blogging and they were live tweeting. And I just wasn't part of that world. So yeah. I like to joke that they kind of dragged me kicking and screaming into it. I have not taken down any of my blog posts. So if you go to the Anti-Poverty Mom blog, you can see some of the hilariously dry and bad ones that are still up there. Gradually, I found my voice instead of just like, okay, here's part, because this is a STEM thing too. What is engineering and STEM do to us when we become writers in our professional engineering degrees? They beat the creativity out of us. They do.
You will make it dry and boring.
When I went to General Motors, my mentor would take something, a report that I wrote, and circle things in red that are like, this is editorializing. We just want the data. And it's like, anytime I tried to make it more readable, they're like, no. So demeaning. But here I had to like reverse that whole thing and change my writing voice and become vulnerable and bring the humor out. And that's what I learned through blogging. And okay, then I naively thought, oh, I've got all these blogs. What I'm going to do is just string together a bunch of blogs and it'll be a book and that'll be easy. That is not the way it works at all. So that's a whole other piece that I don't know if we would necessarily want to talk about, but
no, I do, because I'm actually like curious how you go about writing a book and getting it published.
Sure. Yeah. It was, I will say from the time that I had the idea from this book to actually publishing is about 10 years. Now it doesn't necessarily take that long. I wasn't writing on it the whole time. And please remember that I was having to live these experiences, because at first I thought maybe I might just write a book about being an advocate with babies and toddlers. But now my kids are 16 and 18, and I expanded the book to be about advocating with middle schoolers and high schoolers. So I just had to take the time to live the stories and also to make the connections. One thing I'm proud about in the book is it's not just me talking about my experience. I highlight the stories of many of the moms that I've met that are from diverse backgrounds. So they're moms that don't look like me or talk like me, different economic, racial, geographic backgrounds. So all of those relationships and experiences had to be built up. So that being said, when I started stringing things together, I'm a big outliner. So I had the outline of what I wanted the book to look like. And I kind of grabbed all my different blogs. I'm like, okay, where does this fit? And how does this fit? I worked on it for several years. And then I got to a point where I thought, this is a hot mess. I have an outline. I have a good chunk of it, but then I have all these stories that I'm just not sure how to fit in there. So I had to, or I felt that I needed to engage what is called a developmental editor, which is different than a copy editor. And a wonderful woman named Tammy Ditmore helped me fit all these stories in and kind of massage them into place. So it made a more coherent narrative throughout. And I'm greatly indebted to her for helping me through a block there.
So do you have it written and then you send it to a publisher? Do you have a portion of it written and you send a portion of it to a publisher? Like, at what point do you like get publishing involved for it to become like, this is going to be a real book versus this is going to be something that I put together that does or does not get accepted and people do or do not read?
There's a couple different ways to go about it. Number one, I am happy that I'm a nonfiction writer because I think fiction writers have it harder. Fiction writers need to write the whole thing and submit it and have it edited and beautiful and send it in to publishers and as a whole product. Now, it would be expected there would be some editing afterwards, but nonfiction writers, we're super lucky. We just need the outline and some excerpts. So at any point there, you should be, if you're doing this, you should be submitting it to agents and or publishers. There are three routes that you can take. One is traditional publishing. That's what most people think of when people go, that's great. You don't have to pay anything. We will take your book to our big publishing place and send it out into the world. And maybe you get some sort of advance. That is highly, highly competitive. And even when they agree to take you on, sometimes it still takes 2 or 3 years to get it published. It's just a lengthy process. There can be independent publishers or even sometimes like vanity press where you can kind of have anything you want published, but it may not be the product that you want. I went in between. I have a hybrid publisher called Publish Your Press. And so I paid them a certain amount of money, but they're like a one-stop shop. They're like, yeah, we have great cover artists and great editors, and we will walk you through this whole process. Once I engaged with them in less than a year, I had a book in the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I recommend that middle part because it gets you the professional advice that you need. You know, I tried for about a year to be traditionally published, and that just wasn't in the cards for me.
Okay. We got two questions around that. One, so you said that's the middle ground. And then I'm assuming the other side of that is self-publishing.
Right.
Okay. So you said that you paid them.
Yeah.
At what point do you, or do you think you break even or even start making money? Like, which I'm assuming you're probably not doing it to make money. I don't know of anybody who writes books to make money. So I hear.
Yeah. Especially when you're talking about advocacy and social justice issues in the nonprofit world. It's a really good question. I was just talking about this to another fellow author who's launching a book next month. People have different strategies for this. Some people just don't care and they just want their book out in the world. Some people work very hard to get it bought. One of the strategies that I use, because my book is more or less a training manual for advocates, is I talk to organizations like, for instance, Shot at Life that I mentioned. They helped me launch the book and I was part of their conference this year, and they were so generous that they bought a copy of my book for all participants.
Oh.
So if I can land a bunch of those, then that will quickly pay for the book, because, you know, you're talking about selling hundreds of books at a time. Obviously there's Amazon and that way. Another strategy for me, especially since this is talking about advocacy and training and I'm trying to spread the word to the world. I want to use this book as a way to gain entry to conferences where a lot of mom advocates are, like for instance, PTA, which a lot of people don't know. Parent Teacher Association started out as an advocacy group and they are still very active. A lot of their members need this kind of training through PTA and different advocacy organizations. And then hopefully into the corporate world, I can be doing speaking, and speaking fees, depending on what you're doing, they can be quite lucrative. And so that is my strategy. So if anybody would like to hire me to speak, you can go to changit.com and click on the speaking button and see, I do training workshops and keynotes and things like that.
So now I'm going to ask you about that because this I think is like a whole other interesting topic. So how do you find public speaking? And, you know, so I think there's a difference between like technical presentations and keynoting and things like that. Are you comfortable keynoting? Do you like doing it? Is it energizing? How have you found it to be?
Well, you asked me this question at an interesting time, because I've just done my first keynotes really, and they are highly different than technical speaking.
Yeah. I hired a coach to help me because I had to keynote for a trade association, which is how I got into advocacy, was through the trade association, but I hired a communication coach. Well, I didn't hire. My company that I worked for at the time had him on retainer, and then I've like worked with him since. And for me, that was like life-changing.
Yeah.
Cause it is very different, like to own a stage versus like present technical information.
Right. Which with the technical information, I'm throwing it out there. And it's like, especially with my former jobs, it was just like, I don't really care if you're engaged or not, as far as like in an emotional level, because I am showing you how this brake data is quieter than the data from this other truck. And if you need to know this information, you're going to pay attention. And if you don't, you don't. You know, here I'm trying to touch people's hearts and to get them to care. And my goals are completely different. My goal is to empower women and to inspire people, not just women, but to jump up and to advocate to others, which is a big leap, right? Because I'm trying to encourage them and inspire them to step out of their comfort boundaries.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause that Netflix and couch are really comfortable.
Right. They're very, it's very different, but how have I liked it? I love it. I love this fact that it's allowing me to talk to people that I would not have, you know, run into before in my life, either because I'm going up to talk to the PTA Wisconsin folks, and I'm just not hanging out in Madison, Wisconsin very much anymore, or if it's an organization that I just wasn't familiar with before. So I'm really enjoying that. It did require a little bit of get over myself kind of mindset, that it's like, I have this information, I want to give it to people and as a gift, more or less. One thing that I am uncomfortable with still is COVID. So this has required me to step out into the world unmasked before people at the podium. And that's not so comfortable for me still right now.
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing. I'm working on getting comfortable. I was not comfortable for a very long time. My son has thyroid cancer. He has cancer cells in his lungs. And so I was like super, super careful for a very long time until I hadn't let him like leave the house basically for a year and a half. And at some point I was like, am I damaging him more mentally and socially than I am physically, than I am protecting him physically? I had to like let him be a teenage boy and have a social life. And I will say though, right now I am being very extra careful because I am leaving for Italy in 9 days and I do not want anything to keep me from being able to travel. And yeah, I was going to do a girls trip like 3 weeks ago, and 3 hours before I was leaving to go to the Minneapolis to go to the airport, my friend texted me, tested positive for COVID this morning, whole trip canceled. So I'm like, okay, 4 day girl trip, that's one thing. 2.5 weeks with my daughters in Italy, whole nother thing. I'm like, I am like desperately trying to like protect myself, except my son goes to school, my husband goes to work.
Yeah. I mean, there are necessary things, but when there's something important, it is still time to buckle down. My oldest child is 18 and graduating, and we would all really like to see that graduation ceremony. So, you know, trying to do the best we can. Going back to the other thing you were talking about, my favorite kind of speaking is workshops, though. I think that is like the blend between my engineering experience and my kind of new career here is teaching these advocacy skills with workshops. So that's the sweet spot, because then you get more audience interaction at different pulses. It's like, what do you think about this? And try out this skill.
Yeah. Interaction is great. Honestly. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges with COVID from a standpoint of presenting to a computer screen. Nobody is interacting with you. You can't read the audience. It's so hard.
I agree.
I mean, I am hopeful that things will get better and we will be able to continue. 'Cause I know, like, you know, conferences are starting again in person, and I hope that things will be good enough that we can continue that, because I've missed seeing people. I like interacting with people. Presenting is so much easier. It's just so much more fun when there's people. Turns out I like people. I don't know.
You know how much you liked us until you lost us for a while.
Exactly. Okay. So I want to talk about your engineering career a little bit and how that ties into the advocacy work that you do. But I want to start with, okay, so when we were going to school together, I remember you being super, super smart. And so it does not surprise me whatsoever that you became an engineer. What were your influences to go into engineering? Like, was it your parents? Was it teachers? And we talked a little bit about teachers before, but like, how did you end up going into engineering, and then specifically mechanical engineering?
So it wasn't my parents.
What did they do? I don't even know. Like, I feel bad about this. I feel like I should know.
I don't know what your parents did. They just drove us to things, right?
I didn't have parents. They were just too embarrassing. my dad listens to this podcast. Just kidding, Dad.
Just kidding, Dad. Father's Day is coming up. Just kidding. So my father was a professor of psychology, which is, as I've gotten older.
Okay, where?
Holy cool. At Morehead State University.
Oh my God. Okay. My dad taught engineering, technology, and energy management at Morehead State.
Oh my gosh. Why didn't we see each other on campus running around? Cause I mean, I was a total campus brat, you know, like always using, like swimming and tennis facilities over there in the arcade.
Yeah. So, okay. So I only went over there when, so I did calculus PSEO our senior year. Yeah. That's, and so I would like go hang out in my dad's office, like when I got done with tests and had to wait for like a ride or something.
I mean, from the time that I was allowed to cross streets with bikes, Julie Kirsten and I, or Julie Kirsten,
yeah.
That she and I would ride our bikes over there when we were little and just like hang out on the campus. And
really?
Like we'd be on the tennis court or something. And somebody say, hey, you kids are supposed to be there. And it's like, my dad's a professor.
Okay. All right. So your dad was a professor and somehow at the same college that my dad was, and we somehow never crossed paths. Okay. What about mom?
Weird. And mom was, had several things, but she's always been like in the health field, and she worked at Morehead State as well at the Student Health Center. But later she headed up our Clay County Health Department. Here's just a sweet little thing I want to say about my mom is that for the years that you and I were in high school and my sister, who's 5 years older, my mom used the back of the, she never went through the front door of her office. She always walked the long way around because this was one of the places that teenage girls could get the healthcare that they needed and also birth control. And she didn't want any of our friends to feel like embarrassed about coming there and seeing Cheryl and Cindy's mom there. So this woman for 10 years, snuck around the back. This is an influence right here is what I wanted to say here is that this woman also headed up a health department during a global pandemic, because if you remember, AIDS was very, very scary at that time. Mm-hmm. We had no idea, much like COVID, we had no idea how it was transmitted. We didn't know if it would be through touch or whatever. And
And there's a lot of tons of misinformation and.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, looking back, I have so much admiration for that because we see how people on the front lines of these local policies, it can be very, very difficult. This is also one of the reasons that I wanted to put out this book at this time during COVID, because at no time before has our generation seen how local and state and federal policies can affect what happens in our own homes. During this time of COVID, not just talking about vaccine policies or mask mandates, but also talking about what kind of funding is available for us to do our jobs while we're in the same room with our kids on virtual school and whatnot. I have drifted far from the point again. The influences, but I would say that I did not know it at the time, but that would influence my advocacy. But as far as engineering, I think it was mainly the teachers that we talked about. Both of us very influenced by algebra teacher, Mr. Argent.
I loved him. He was the best teacher.
What's his first? Does it start with an A? It's terrible. I can see his face so clearly. Anyway, Mr. Argent.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Mr. Anderson, Chrissy Anderson's dad. All of these teachers that
I forgot about him.
Yeah, I'm still Facebook friends with him.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think that
Buzz Argent.
Buzz Argent, that's right. Thank you. I think that at the time, there must have been a push for teachers to identify the female students who were good at math and science.
What?
You don't think so?
Oh, I never, I don't recall it one way or the other. Like I have friends who were discouraged from going into engineering at other schools. I don't recall anyone being encouraging, but I don't recall anyone being discouraging. And I had my dad taught engineering technology. So he was like a huge influence in my life. Yeah. Like, I mean, from a standpoint of like going into engineering, but I just don't remember anyone going, I remember like enjoying math. I don't remember anyone going like, you should go into engineering, but like, did you have that?
It was okay and stuff, but engineering was not on my radar. So I had to be pushed and sort of corralled and nudged to go into.
So who pushed and corralled you and nudged you?
I would say that it was some of those, a couple of those teachers that we've mentioned, and Mrs. Schwert was my calculus teacher. Do I have that name right? And also like college counseling, which I don't really remember like our counselors' names and stuff like that. But, mm-hmm. You know, we took some tests for aptitude and things like that. And that was when it was like really put before me, like, you know, you can do this and you should do this. Another roundabout influence though, was Disney.
I saw that you interned there.
Sort of. I was on the college program for Walt Disney World and Disneyland. I never actually-
The college program. What is the college program for Disney World and Disneyland?
The college program still exists, and it's where they invite college students to come down and you work for minimum wage in the parks. It's mainly set up for people in the hospitality industry. Some of my college program colleagues, they would work in the hotels if they were in hotel and restaurant management that was like really good for them. Engineering students were stuck on food because there wasn't really anything for us to do in the park.
I'm thinking rides. Like you're going into mechanical engineering.
Yeah, but they wouldn't put like untrained college students in charge of safety and stuff
I even think it.
We could have worked attractions. It's true, but
food and engineering. Well, I guess, okay. There is food engineering.
There is. It's kind of funny. I recently came across a letter where I had forgotten that existed. That I had always said, well, I wasn't really able to make I wanted to be an engineer, an Imagineer. That was the whole thing. I was obsessed with Disney when I was in high school. And that was once people said like engineering could be a thing, I'm like, oh, it sounds kind of boring, but I could be an Imagineer. I felt like I was going to try to do that and try to make connections that way. I kind of told myself this narrative that I was never accepted that way into those programs and that I went to GM as a second choice, but I recently came across a piece of paper that says that's not true. It was actually an invitation to have an unpaid internship in California with Imagineering that I guess I had forgotten about or blocked out. I had made the decision that I was going to intern at General Motors, which is actually more of a co-op. The difference there being I would be paid and I would start to accrue seniority. So if I work,
important.
Yes. And also I got a 20% discount on a car.
Oh, like, that's also nice.
That's how I bought my first car.
Especially when you're young and have probably not had a new
car. Yeah. So there's like dream company Imagineering had offered me something, but for no pay, or General Motors, which was offering me a lot. And by the way, they ended up paying for my master's degree in a program that they had and a start of a career. And so I actually did make that decision. It wasn't just like, boo, I never could do what I wanted to do. I made a conscious choice and then forgot about it.
Oh, that's interesting. Because now you're making me wonder, like, did you repress it? Because possibly, and I'm just going to speculate for a minute, you can tell me if this is like a correct speculation or not. Your career ended up not going the way that you had intended it for it to go. So do you think it was like your brain like repressed it as a way to like protect yourself versus just like forgetting?
I think that's true, which is, you know, usually we talk about repressed memories, we talk about trauma and stuff like that, but
that
I think
could be trauma though, right? Because I mean but like a slow trauma, right? Versus like a fast trauma, because you have so much invested in your career and your education and stuff, and then if it isn't what you want it to be, I still think that's traumatic.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I try to tell my own kids and any kids that cross my path. And you sent a young man my way who's thinking about what to first major in and things like that. And one of my big messages to them is it's okay to change your mind. Mm-hmm. It's totally okay to change your mind.
Even when you're 30, 40, or 50.
Yeah. I'm doing something totally different. And you know, looking back, I don't regret that Imagineering decision at all now, because I am a big believer in being paid for what you're worth.
Mm-hmm. Especially when they're getting paid, right? I mean, it's, yep. Disney's not cheap to go to or to buy or anything else.
Yeah. And I think that the work that I'm doing is life-saving and empowering and so much better for me and better for the world than anything else I've done in my career. I'm still glad that I have all the background in that, mm-hmm. because I think my background enables me to do that, this work now.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to go there because I want to talk about how they relate to each other, but mm-hmm. I'm curious, and we talked a little bit about this, like on our intro call, but when you made the decision to stay home with your kids and to quit engineering, mm-hmm. I had a couple of questions around there. One, was it, I am done with this forever. And I know, like when we talked about this, like, it, you know, like things weren't going well at your company and, you know, you were concerned about your job and things like that. It was what?
They made it super easy to leave.
Did you have an intention of going back at some point into engineering? And did the fact that you did not end up going back into engineering, but then found this whole other like lifeline that you are super passionate about, which I could absolutely tell just in talking with you and the fact that you write a book about it, not that it like made up for it, but you found this whole other passion. But did you at one time think that you would go back into engineering and go back to working? Or was it like, I am done with this and this is just not for me?
Well, I did not burn any bridges when I left because I
never
expected,
want to.
Yeah, never a good idea. But I expected at some point to go back, maybe not to that particular company. They were laying people off left and right. I should clarify with, you know, what I was joking about before about making it really easy to leave. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny. Every time that I made a move in engineering, it seemed like the ship was burning behind me. I left General Motors for MSC at a time when General Motors was laying a ton of people off and they were facing some huge financial problems as a company. And then Material Science Corporation that we're talking about here, when I left to raise the kids, it was almost the same thing there. I don't even know what they're doing now, but I thought that I would kind of go back. But as the years went by, I felt that maybe I wouldn't, because, you know, it's a funny thing with those STEM careers and stuff like that. It's like, if you're not keeping current, then they're, with every year that I stayed away, there's like a widening gap of like, well, what software are people using now? Mm. And, you know, what's going on in the industry and things like that. I probably could have, because I had gotten to a point where I was a project manager. By the way, that's a super useful skill for anything you want to do. Like project management, taking that with me to manage like volunteers in an advocacy group, it's still the same skill there. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you the story about when I worked for General Motors. There was a little grade school not far from, I worked for the GM Proving Grounds, and they started allowing us to mentor over there to go and be math or science mentors. It was just like this little thing that came up that you could go over there for an hour a week during your workday. And I was like, well, that sounds cool and mm-hmm. interesting. And yeah. That hour was always the best hour of my week. And that should have been a clue that maybe I wasn't doing what I was intended to be doing on the earth, interacting with the kids and helping kids who were struggling with the math. Cause I didn't like work with the gifted kids. I was working with the kids that had problems. And, you know, sometimes those problems weren't necessarily the math problems. Right.
Right.
So I always had this other side of me that was, you know, engaged in a softer skill set of emotions.
Okay. So this I think is like interesting because I hadn't thought about this until I had a podcast guest, Jayshree Sate, 3M, on my podcast. And she talked about how she like, so her parents wanted her to go into engineering, but she really didn't want to until she could connect engineering to helping people.
Oh, yeah.
And how, so she calls it STEM. So science, humanity, engineering.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
And math. and how she thinks that one of the ways that we can get more girls interested in STEM is to make those connections. And I think like, and I think it's regardless of, you know, like what kind of engineering you're going into, because you worked as a mechanical engineer on brake systems. Do I have that right?
Among other,
you're saving lives, right? I mean, you're keeping people safe.
Yep.
I worked for utility. People need electricity, but I don't think that we necessarily, that was never a tie to anything that I did. And I think that that can be an important tie, because the things that we do as engineers, as technologists, as computer science scientists, whatever it might be, it's all tied to humanity and all tied to humans generally and making their lives better, hopefully. I mean, in some cases it makes it worse, but I don't think you intentionally set out to make it worse, right? Like nobody does.
No.
And I think that that tie is,
we really want our bridges to stay up.
We really do. Yes. Very, very bad when they fall down. But I thought that was like a really interesting thing that it really had never occurred to me until I had this conversation with her about this. And I think
I would have enjoyed that. It would have inspired me and helped me to put more of my heart into it. I mean, when I said among other things, this is because when I was a co-op, I did tours through different parts of the proving ground. So I've worked in safety, I've worked in emissions, and like you mentioned, brakes. And it's like all of those things, like working in the safety department. Okay. That was pretty cool with the crash sleds and stuff like that. Very.
I had a crash test engineer on my podcast. I'm like, yeah. That was a thing.
Woo-hoo! Yeah. You know, they're very dramatic and entertaining to watch those tests. And emissions, right? This is like climate, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody ever made that connection for me. You know, we talked about pollution and stuff like that, but climate was not talked about in the way that it is now, back in the early 90s.
Should have been. Well, I believe that Al Gore was trying.
Yes.
Yeah, like the one-man band at the time.
I didn't even have the internet to see it. But yeah, I agree with that. And now I want to go and listen to that podcast, because I think that that would have helped me a lot at that time.
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, how do we make those changes to like incorporate that globally versus having like one-off conversations about it? Because it wasn't anything that was like, you know, that, like I said, it wasn't anything I thought about. I will say that there was a point. So I worked at a electric cooperative, and there was a point that I was having a conversation with our transmission vice president, and he talked about, you know, we're bringing electricity to people who would not have it. I mean, that's like the whole co-op environment. And that was very perspective changing for me from a standpoint of like, we are truly doing something that helps people, which makes you like, I have a whole better viewpoint of your job, quite honestly. Cause you're like, I'm helping people. Even though like your job is very technical, you're helping people make these changes. You're helping people have something that they need. But I think like just those paradigm shifts are really critical in having your heart in something versus like, this is a job for making money.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned that part, and I don't know what year that was that you were working on that, but I have worked with or volunteered with the One Campaign on passing the Electrify Africa Act. Which I loved that campaign, because, you know, electricity infrastructure can sound like kind of dry, but during that whole maybe just, you know, some lawmakers on Capitol Hill, but this is like my job as an advocate, right, is to take something like that and force people through stories and personal connection to force lawmakers to come to terms with the fact that these are very humanitarian issues that we're talking about. So if we have, and now, you know, I didn't prepare this part of it, it's been a couple of years since we worked on it, but if you have X percent of communities on this big continent that are not connected to stable electricity, you know, what does that mean for maternal health? For, you know, us taking it for granted that we can go to a hospital and there will be lights on when we want to deliver a baby or something like that. Bringing some of those really emotional stories to the forefront is like, this is what it means to not have electricity.
I've been to Africa Utilities Week twice in Cape Town. So I've actually like,
you know, more about it than I do. You talk about it for a while.
No, it's super interesting because it's like going back to I want to say maybe like the 1940s in the US when things were like just being electrified and things were, you know, very, we talk about microgrids, but that's really what Africa has. They have microgrids. They have just like a generator or a solar, you know, solar power for their community, which may or may not be reliable. I was going to say something else and now I just totally lost my train of thought. Being 50.
While you're thinking about it, I'll yes and all of that. And like one of the pieces of global health equipment that is I've been talking about lately is very exciting is there's something called a gene expert machine, which prior to COVID, I'd been talking a lot about tuberculosis, which was the most it's like the infectious disease killing the most people in the world every year.
Until now.
But here's the thing. We had developed these gene expert machines where people could spit into a cup and in 20 minutes get it analyzed and know whether they had tuberculosis or not. It's like, woo, that sounds pretty cool. But it's really cool because people might have to walk for the better part of a day or days to go to a place where they could get health resources, submit their samples for testing, and then it might take a couple days to get that back. And they couldn't wait around for that to happen. So they would walk back to wherever they lived and, you know, they couldn't take all that time off of work. So they're continue working. So let's say you get a positive back for TB. Well, that person has just walked all the way, infecting people along the way, going back, infecting people at work before they get their result back. So why does this become important then later is like, it turns out that the gene expert machine, everything that we put in place for tuberculosis, it worked for COVID.
Oh.
So people were able to get COVID results. The bad part is that we had to reallocate, that was allocated for COVID then, and we are missing a lot of, it's estimated like 1 million undiagnosed TB patients didn't get diagnosed during that time. But what do we need for all that to work? Electricity.
I know.
It's, your gene expert critical. Machine is just a big lump sitting there if you don't have
no,
it.
No, it's super, super critical. And it's not always seen as being as critical as it is. And so what I worked on, so I'm a telecommunications engineer. So I worked on communications and I would have the most frustrating conversations at the FCC because utilities don't have a spectrum in order to do communications. And we're like, okay, so you have like what you just described as being probably like the most important thing in order to like make the world work, right? Like electricity like underpins everything. We have no dedicated spectrum for communications, which is what keeps our electric grid up. And so that was the advocacy that I was doing. I was going to the FCC and Department of Energy and, you know, trying to make people understand. And it, honest to God, it was like banging your head against a brick wall because they don't get it. And it works, right? Like, I mean, it's very rare that your electricity goes out. And usually if it does, it's local, but there's going to be a point that something happens and it's going to be communication related. And we'll have our own like 9/11 incident, which will then probably bring about the changes that needed to be made 20, 30 years ago. Anywho,
we have ranged all over from these, you know, different kinds of things that need to be advocated for. And, you know, this is one of the things that I wanted people to see with my book is that they can be involved in all these different kinds of advocacy. And these are what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say the world is far too big for one person to take on like all the issues that need to be talked about. And I mainly work on global health these days. Sometimes I also work on gun violence. Sometimes I also work on reproductive rights and sometimes US poverty and housing. I do these things, but my main focus is global health. And when I do these other things,
all those things that you just brought up relate to global health.
They're all health. That's not a mistake. It's not a mistake. They are all related. But the thing is like, I can't be everywhere at once. And I would get frustrated with that sometimes. And like, okay, I have two kids that I raised to be advocates. So, you know, that's wonderful. I managed to biologically produce a couple more advocates.
I'm pretty impressed with, because I usually can't get my kids to do anything I want them to do. So good job.
Maybe it was effective in my case, but it's not an efficient method for growing a movement. So
they have a lot of kids.
your water out. But I thought maybe writing this book could reach people who are going to advocate on things that I care about, that I just can't be doing everything. So the best thing I can do is work on growing the movement. So thank you for having me on the podcast, because this, you know, puts it out further there that hopefully we can reach more people.
I think that people have this idea that their voice doesn't make a difference. And I think that that can be true, but it can also be that your voice can make a difference. And I think what you're showing, like through your book and through your work that you're doing, is that one person can make a difference. Yeah. And that your voice does matter, but you have to use your voice differently, and you can't keep your voice quiet. You can't just bitch about it in your house.
I have a workshop that I did that it was called Turning Rants into Letters to the Editor.
Oh, I like that.
I did it at a time where something was happening politically, and I was seeing a lot of my friends write really long Facebook rants. And I would look at them and go, huh, with just a little bit of cleaning up, that's a really powerful letter to the editor. And so I thought about it a little bit, and I kind of repackaged my workshop about letters to the editor. And I invited a few of my friends on who I had seen have these longish Facebook rants. And one of them, I had talked to her about it separately. And she then took that rant and submitted it to a paper and got published.
Really?
Right. And so, you know, we talk a lot about like, hey, how come my members of Congress aren't reading my personal Facebook page and, you know, paying attention to me? Well, you got to put it in the right spot.
That's interesting.
But there's a few stories that I tell in the book about how, you know, once I could be shown where to be in the right place at the right time, there's a little bit that I a pull-out box where I talk about a time that I called my member of Congress, asked her to sign on to something. And it was just my one phone call that an aide called back and said, oh, because you asked for that, Congresswoman Schakowsky signed on for that. So thanks for bringing it to our attention. I hung up and I was just in shock. And like my kids were napping, so I couldn't like yell and be excited about it. So I ended up just kind of like doing the chicken dance in place and being happy about it. But I couldn't believe that it was as simple is that. And it's not always as simple as that, but you know, it certainly can be.
Okay. I'm going to wrap it back to something we talked about kind of like when we were talking about doing the intro for the podcast. So from a standpoint of what came out yesterday of the news that was leaked on Roe v. Wade and advocacy, and this is about women in STEM, which I think a lot of us have a lot of, well, how can you not? Anyway, I'm just going to say, how can you not have an opinion on this? But from an advocacy standpoint, what the hell do we do?
Well, the first part is, I think, recognizing that, you know, whatever you may feel, and there's a lot of complicated feelings around reproductive rights and abortions. In fact, my colleague, Katie Zay, she's a Christian reverend, and she wrote a book called A Complicated Choice, which I recommend to everybody, talking about, she tells the stories of some moms who have had, or not moms, I'm so used to talking about my own book, of people who have had abortions, and it's not, their decisions are not straightforward. It is often right. Very complicated.
It's not, and our feelings, black and white all the time, or even much of the time.
Our feelings about it can be so much in turmoil that it can stop us from talking about it. But it's, I think the first step is realizing that if we're silent and we're not talking about it, messy feelings and all, there are people on the other side who are very clear about what they want and how they want certain rights taken away. And they are very, very loud and very, very influential. And I just want to talk about one instance of that there's a group, the Right to Life Action Coalition of Ohio. These are advocates that are working for Right to Life and stuff like that. They had the ear of an Ohio Republican Representative John Becker. He, in December 2009, he consulted with them and he crafted a bill that spread some really dangerous misinformation about reproductive health and pregnancy. And we're talking here about ectopic pregnancies, where a pregnancy starts in the fallopian tubes, where a baby cannot form. That's not a pregnancy that's viable. Mm-hmm. And it's really dangerous for the mother, and the mother can die. He said in the bill that it was a bill that would prevent insurance companies from covering abortion procedures, except for ectopic pregnancies that can be re-implanted into the uterus. And that is not true. They cannot be. But he got that information from some activists who were just saying the wrong thing. So if you're not out there saying true things and factual things, there are people out there that are influencing people who are not. So it's like, by not saying anything, you're kind of ceding the position to people who are spreading misinformation. And I'm excited to talk about this on your podcast, which is talking about STEM, because it kind of shows how all of us need a working STEM background, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, engineering to know what we, you know, is physically possible for global health and electricity, or if we're talking about, you know, biology and just knowing how basic things about how the body works. It's so important for us as voters to be able to make right decisions.
Well, and I think that people may have this idea that there is more knowledge that goes into these bills than there is. Like, they don't necessarily have the, you know, specialists and people that are doctors and engineers and scientists that are working on these. And I think that there's this idea that, you know, the government, you know, they're, well, the, you know, they'll consult with the people that know that, but they don't. Right. And I don't think that people necessarily know that. And you're right. It's really important to have people who have those backgrounds and have that information to be out there advocating so that misinformation does not get put into laws that jeopardize our health or our safety or our lives.
I was definitely somebody who thought in my 20s and 30s that people in Congress, people who are elected, they know much more than me, and they have so many more resources at their fingertips that I would think, mistakenly, I would think things like, what more do I have to say in the conversation? What could I possibly add? Why would it be important for them to hear from me? And as I have been more and more involved in this, I see that we have a lot to say, and our perspectives, whether you're a mom, whether you're a teacher or an engineer or something like that, you have your own expertise and you have your own reasons to care. And that's why you should be doing these things and stepping up.
And okay, so I just got done editing a podcast with Catherine Hamilton, and she was talking about the Reconciliation Act. She said it is over 1 million pages. And so even if you are knowledgeable and you're in Congress, which I'm going to go with, they're not all that knowledgeable. Nobody can read 1 million pages of anything to know what's in a bill. That's insane. And right. So we have to be better, I think, in order to provide influence and impact. And so that our representatives are representing us versus representing themselves.
And that goes back to something that I say over and over again. If you want to get involved in advocacy on any particular issue, find an organization. I would recommend a reputable nonpartisan organization. I know that's not everybody's flavor, but.
No, I 1,000% agree with you though.
Yeah. I'm a big believer in the nonpartisan organizations because the, just a little digression here, the majorities in Congress are so thin as far as the Senate goes, that at any given election, you could be flipping and changing who's in power. So you have to be talking to people on both sides of the aisle if you, you know, want to make progress on your issue over a long period of time. Because the organization does have some people who are on staff and paid to read those bills. with the expertise to mm-hmm. get to those parts that have to do with your issue, because the reconciliation bill is huge, the farm bill, huge, but they can get to the parts that matter and decipher the legalese and say, okay, this is what this bill is really saying, and take mm-hmm. it back to make those recommendations, because nobody's got time for that.
I don't even know how, like, does anyone actually read a million pages? Like, that's not even physically possible. Like, it's just.
No. And I don't think anybody like reads it like straight through. You have people who are looking.
They divide it up. I'm assuming they just must divide it up. I don't know how else you could do it.
Like, I'm not in the room where it happens. From time to time, when something comes through, like a resolution or a bill that's like really short, and I, you know, maybe it's on global nutrition or something like that, I will tell the people that I'm coaching, or, you know, my own advocacy group, is like, read this one. It's only 3 pages.
Well, like, okay, so I was just going to say, like your book, 278 pages. I was pretty proud of myself for making it through that. That's not even close to a million.
I want to say just a little something about that. My goal when I wrote proposals for this book, that it was going to be a 200-page book. I felt very strongly about that. And then a whole bunch of pages got added in 2020 when COVID came along.
Ooh.
Because two things happened. I could not ignore COVID, because I was like, rah, rah, we've made all this progress on global maternal child health. And
we just went backwards.
COVID has undeniably set us back at least a decade, maybe more like 15 years on progress on that. So you can't release a book and not at least address that. I also added parts about how my family dealt with COVID, and how having a couple of teenagers who were also global health advocates really helped us get through it together.
It might've been nice for my son. Might've been helpful. He was very, very angry with me.
And the other thing that happened in 2020 were the Black Lives Matter protests. And I looked at my book and went, oh, I don't have a section on protests, which is...
Oh.
It's not my favorite method of advocacy, but it is a valid and legal method of advocacy. So I went, I'm not an expert on this. So I went and I interviewed all my friends who regularly take their kids to protest. So if you flip to that section, you will find other people's voices that I called their expertise on for that section.
Well, I was going to say, you have like a page of notes in every chapter. You have questions. So it's not necessarily 278, because you've got like some stuff for people to like write in,
yep.
Which isn't there's reading. So
there's pictures. There's even pictures. My family, I don't expect family members to read my whole book, but they do seem to like looking at the pictures of my kids.
Pictures books, not just for children anymore.
I will stop at this moment and say that my mom says that she's read every page of it. That's what she says. So
my dad has listened to all my podcasts.
Wow. They must love us.
They must. They must have worked under their skin.
You claimed that you have the attention span of a gnat these days. And that is very much how I felt when I had like toddlers. Like, there's my own attention span, and there was like how my life was at that time, you know, being, oh, I was going to read this, but now one of them's woken up for a nap, or they're wanting my attention. So I intentionally wrote it. What's that?
I don't think mine went back after having toddlers.
But knowing that, I wrote it that way so that you can, and I give people permission in the introduction to skip around. Like, mm-hmm. So I tried to make it so that I don't use jargony terms that some authors do. This, they define it at the beginning and then you run into these terms later. But if you didn't read the beginning part, you don't get it. So I just tried to speak plainly throughout so that you didn't need to read it consecutively.
Well, I love it. I think it's a great book. I'm going to pass it on to my coworker who wants to get into advocacy, because I'm a minimalist and so I don't keep things, but I'm going to gift it to somebody else who is like really wanting to get into that. And okay. So I always end with asking, not exactly sure how I want to phrase this. So, okay. So typically I ask for what advice you'd give to a girl or young woman thinking about going into STEM, but since you were in the advocacy world, what would be your advice?
Well, I've already given the advice, I think, that I would.
Other than read your book.
What's that?
How to, other than read your book, because it's a whole how to, tons of advice. It's a whole book of advice.
Well, I'm going to give the advice for the STEM one anyway. And in addition to that, but it's what we said earlier in the podcast, that if you're going into it, go into it with your whole heart, but know that it's okay to change your mind. And STEM is very, very big. So if you want to change direction, that is okay. If you want to take the learnings from STEM and do something else, then that is a blessing to your next career. So that's for that. For advocacy, again, I think that the most powerful advocacy is relational, and not only building a relationship with a member of Congress, but building up a relationship with the people around you who do that work. So harping on that again, getting involved with an organization, but if you don't have one in mind, grab the people around you. Like you said, Kathy, it's got discussion questions in the book that you can talk about together. And what's the phrase? It's an African proverb that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Mm-hmm. My advice is go together.
Great advice on a number of different, the proverb is great advice for a number of different things. Great advice on advocacy and also STEM. Well, Cynthia, I've had an absolutely fun time just talking with you and catching up and hearing about your book and all the work that you've done and all the stuff that has gone on since we talked like 30 some years ago. It's so crazy.
I have loved reconnecting with you, and I hope that we get to go together on our journeys, more in the next 30 years.
Yeah, we should definitely keep in touch. I'm so glad that we've been able to reconnect. It's been awesome. And I'm so glad you're doing this work. It makes me so happy.
Same here. They keep having those good conversations. I love it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. You can find a list of definitions, acronyms, and a fact check in the episode notes. You can also find links to all of the resources that Cynthia mentioned throughout the episode. If you like this podcast, please like it, share it, and tell your friends. And if you'd like to get episodes delivered right to you, you can follow or subscribe. And you can find me, Kathy Nelson, at www.ordinarily-extraordinary.com. Thanks, and please join me for future episodes.